Hello and welcome to this podcast with Physics World. I'm James Dacey, the multimedia editor for the magazine. In today's programme, we're going to be discussing a selection of the best physics books that we have reviewed in 2013. I'm joined by a tenacious trio of journalists from the Physics World team, who will each be making the case for one of their favourite books of the year, chosen from our shortlist of 10. We have the magazine's editor, Mateen Durrani. We have the reviews editor, Margaret Harris. And finally, we have Tushna Kamasariat, a reporter for Physics World. Towards the end of the show, we'll be revealing which of the books on the shortlist has been chosen as our book of the year. Now, Mateen, I understand that this year it's been particularly difficult to pick out one book above the others.
That's right, James. This is the fifth time Physics World has awarded its book of the year. And previously, there was always a clear front runner for the top slot. But this year's choice was a lot tighter. And we're going to look at three books in particular that stood out for us before revealing the winner.
So Tushna, what is it you guys are looking for in a science book for our audience?
Well, the main criteria we're using to judge our science books are that they're well written, they're scientifically interesting and novel. Now, well written is self-explanatory. Scientifically interesting, it's interesting to our audience, which is mainly made up of professional physicists, people who are actually studying the subject, and people who have a keen interest in it. And when we say novel, we're looking for something that's either a book on a new subject area altogether, or a book on a topic that has been covered, but it's now being presented to us in a really new, different, more compelling manner. It sort of piques our interest in the subject once more.
Right, should we push on with your favourites on the shortlist? Margaret, do you want to get us underway?
Sure, James. The book that I really liked this year is called The Spark of Life, Electricity in the Human Body. It's by Francis Ashcroft, physiologist at the University of Oxford, and the book is about the role that electricity plays in the human body and the scientists who figured it out. And they range from clear back to the 18th century when the Italian physicist Luigi Galvani was sending electrical current through dead frogs, making them twitch, thus showing that electricity might have something to do with the spark of life, to more recent work, including Ashcroft's own research. What I liked about it is the way it illuminates a whole different area of research. Ashcroft shares some great anecdotes about what it's like to work in this field. And the most memorable for me was that squid have unusually large axons or nerve fibers. And that's great if you want to insert an electrode into them. So a lot of the early research in neuroelectricity took place using squid axons, and which obviously meant you had to capture squid to do it. And she mentions that at one particular lab, the axons which generated the best results were actually sort of flicked onto the ceiling afterwards, so that the ceiling was covered in what she calls a pattern of dried out squiggles, somewhat reminiscent of a Jackson Pollock painting. And then she says, only the very best axons, however, were sent to heaven. And I love that because it just illuminates what it's like to do research in this field. It doesn't just tell you something, it shows you what it's like.
So you say she talks about some of the electrical processes in the human body. Do you want to give us an example of one of these?
Yeah, so Ashcroft's research is about the role of ion channels in diabetes, and she helps show that people who are born with diabetes have a mutation in a particular ion channel, that this mutation prevents the pancreas from releasing insulin, which is the hormone our bodies need to be able to process sugar. It's interesting to me because my mother's got type 1 diabetes, which isn't the form that Ashcroft was studying, but it's still very interesting to me to find out more about the physiology of it.
So from the part I read at least, it's clear the book is aimed at a popular audience. Did Ashcroft manage to keep you engaged even when explaining some of the harder concepts?
Well, James, it was occasionally tough going for me, but that's, I think, because I took my first and only biology class when I was 14. I think even physicists will probably have a higher average level of biology knowledge than me, and certainly a lot of the general public will. So I think actually that's probably not a problem for the book.
Right, let's move on to our next book then. The author of this one had a rather unusual way of doing his research for the book. He basically spent a lot of time sitting on the couch watching cartoons. Tushna, tell us about this one.
Yes, James. So I read and reviewed The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, written by Simon Singh. He has a PhD in particle physics from Cambridge, and he's the author of many other best-selling science books, including Fermat's Last Theorem. And when I mentioned The Simpsons, I was actually referring to the long-running animated TV show that seems to have this rather unexpected but concrete mathematical vein running through it. The Simpsons is centred on a couple, Homer and Marge, and their three children, Bart, Lisa and Maggie. And the maths element comes in because out of a team of 20 scriptwriters, 4 or 5 of them actually have advanced degrees in physics, maths, and computer science. And it's these people who have, over the years, sort of systematically included a near PhD's worth of mathematics into the show.
So do you want to give us an example of where the scriptwriters have weaved maths into a plot?
Oh, where have they not woven maths into the plot, James? There was an episode in 1993 called Marge in Chains. In that episode, Marge is arrested for shoplifting after she forgets to pay for something at the local grocery shop, the Quickie Mart. And Marge's lawyer is trying to prove that Apu, who owns the Quickie Mart, doesn't have a very good memory. Now, Apu has an excellent memory, or so it goes in the plot of the show. He says that he was called Mr. Memory back home in India. And the way Apu proves that is by saying that he actually knows pi to 40,000 decimal places, and the 40,000th decimal place of pi is 1. The interesting part is back then there was no Google, no Wikipedia. You couldn't just go onto the internet and find out what the 40,000th digit of pi was. So the scriptwriters actually got in touch with a mathematician at NASA called David Bailey. And he was sort of this pi expert at that time. And he actually printed out all 40,000 digits of pi and posted it to the studio, and they used it. So that kind of shows you the kind of dedication that went in to really getting the maths in there and getting it right.
So as well as telling these anecdotes of maths in Simpsons episodes, Singer's also included what he describes as maths examinations. These are basically sets of maths jokes where if you get the pun, you pass the test. So do you want to hit us with a couple of these, Tishna?
Sure, James. One of my favourite jokes was, what do you call a young Eigen sheep?
No idea.
A lambda.
Oh, God.
And this is apparently one of Singh's favourite maths jokes. What does the B in Benoit B. Mandelbrot stand for?
I think I've actually heard this one, so I'm not going to say.
Poutine? No idea.
Stands for Benoit B. Mandelbrot.
Oh, is it self-computing?
Exactly.
Scales.
Well done, James.
Right, so on that rather geeky note, let's move on to our final book. This one tackles a much more open-ended subject. Poutine, over to you.
Yeah, James, this book is Physics in Mind, A Quantum View of the Brain by the author Werner Lowenstein, who's a professor of physiology and biophysics at Columbia University in New York. And what Lowenstein's doing is tackling one of the biggest questions in science, how the brain works. And basically his premise is that if we're going to understand how the brain works, this mysterious object on all of our heads, it's as much a question of physics as it is about biology. And he shows in the book where quantum physics plays a role in the brain, although he's careful not to say that he understands how the brain works using quantum physics. Quantum physics plays a role, and it's important to find out how. And for example, we know that the brain is this really, really complex structure with about 100,000 neurons per cubic millimetre. And given that complexity, the brain doesn't process information one bit at a time in serial. It does lots of operations in parallel because that's quicker and more efficient. And Lowenstein's point is that there's no better way of processing in parallel than with a quantum computer. And although we've only got rudimentary quantum computers in the lab, he says that we need to understand quantum computing if we're going to understand how the brain works. And now, he's not saying he understands how the brain works, but we need to use these concepts from quantum physics if we're going to ever solve that big challenge of understanding the brain.
So the book's central argument seems pretty clear then, to give a physical view of consciousness, but do those 300 pages play out in such a clear and concise way?
Well, the book is a bit heavy going in parts. I mean, I liken it to a bit of an intellectual roller coaster. There's some really fantastic passages. There are some bits that get a bit stickier for me. But when the author's on safe physics ground, there are really some superb explanations, for example, about the nature of time and how quantum computers work. And there are some descriptions of those that are as good as any I've ever seen. But there are some bits that are tricky to explain. And for example, he uses a strange analogy to Maxwell's demon to explain how information is processed. And there's quite a bit about how certain structures in the body evolved, which I felt I didn't need to know about. But he has some really lovely turns of phrase, some beautiful descriptions, although there are occasions when he overdoes it a bit.
Right, thanks for that, Mateen. So Margaret Tishner and Mateen have each pitched a book from our top 10 shortlist. Before we reveal the winner, were there any other books on the shortlist you'd like to mention, Margaret?
Yes, James. So we looked very carefully at all the books on our shortlist, and obviously the three we've just talked about are kind of our three personal favorites. There was one other book that we seriously considered for the top slot, and that was Sean Carroll's The Particle at the End of the Universe, which is his book about the discovery of the Higgs boson. It's also a very good book, but it's not the only book that's been written about the Higgs boson, and B, more importantly, the field of particle physics and cosmology has been so well covered by popular science writing that it's a real struggle for any book in that genre to meet the criterion to be novel. And that's not a criticism of Carroll at all. It's more a criticism of the way the field of popular science writing has worked, because, you know, it's actually represented only a very tiny fraction of physicists' work in popular science so far.
Right, so from these 10 books, we then whittle it down to three books that these guys have just discussed. I mean, the thing that strikes me about the three of them is that they are very different types of science book. I mean, The Spark of Life is a personal history of a particular scientific field, and then The Simpsons book that Tushna talked about is quirky and it's designed to entertain. And then finally, Physics in Mind is a more serious academic type of book, which offers a new way of looking at a field. Do you think it's fair to say that all three authors have perhaps overstated their cases somewhat? I mean, seeing as they're claiming that the ultimate desire of Simpsons writers is to drip-feed maths, then surely the ultimate desire is to entertain.
Well, yes, you're definitely right there, James. I think it's also fair to say that for those four or five scriptwriters who have their degrees and their love of maths, maybe it was their ultimate desire to drip-feed this maths, and they definitely tried to get in there with every episode and tried to put as much in as they could. But maybe for the rest of the writing team, not so much. It is definitely mainly to entertain.
I mean, how about Lernstein? I mean, from the book's cover, it makes it seem like you're going to get this physical explanation of consciousness, but in the end, as you said, you kind of stop short of that. So does that leave you a bit frustrated as well?
Well, I think in the book Physics in Mind, Lowenstein's really careful to say, this is what we do know, this is what we don't know, this is what is certain, and this is my speculation. And he really does draw that distinction. He could have gone a lot further. I know some authors have tried to explain too much or claim they know too much about how the brain works. He doesn't. He's very, very careful what we do know and what we don't know. And to me, that's always the sign of a really good popular science book.
Absolutely.
And with Ashcroft, you know, it sounds like she's tried to cram in an awful lot. I mean, is that problematic?
I think it is a little bit. For example, the book's subtitle is Electricity in the Human Body, but she does actually talk about electricity in plants and electricity in other animals. While I found some of these diversions fascinating, I mean, I didn't know, for example, that we don't understand exactly how the electric eel doesn't shock itself when it shocks its prey. So I liked some of the diversions, but they were diversions and they did get you a bit sidetracked from Ashcroft's main message.
Okay, so Margaret, I'm going to leave it to you to unveil what we've chosen as the 2013 Book of the Year.
Well, the winner, James, after much debate, as we said, as we tried to present in this podcast, is Physics in Mind by Werner Lowenstein. This is a book that is maybe not head and shoulders above the rest, but it definitely has its nose in front just because of the sheer immensity of the subject it's tackling and the excitement with which Lowenstein writes about it.
And I think it's definitely fair to say that anyone who wants to tackle a subject such as this one is going to have a hard time with it. And Lowenstein has really done a good job with it. He's really done it justice. And maybe he's set the path for others to follow.
Well, Tushman, I thought Physics in Mind by Werner Lowenstein is a real masterpiece of a book. I mean, it's a flawed masterpiece, but it's a masterpiece. And like a really great pop album, there are a few tracks that are forgettable. But overall, it's really ambitious. It's really well written. And, you know, I think deservedly wins our prize this year.
So there you have it, folks. Our Book of the Year 2013 is Physics in Mind, A Quantum View of the Brain by Werner Lowenstein. Congratulations to him and all the other writers on our shortlist. And thanks, Margaret, Tushna and Mateen, for the interesting debates. I'm sure you've lined up some excellent reading there for our listeners. You can see the full shortlist for our Books of the Year on our website, physicsworld.com, where you can also read book reviews taken from Physics World, which is published every month. Thank you for joining us today, and we hope you've enjoyed listening. Goodbye.